Hello and welcome back to Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. I have the Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure, Dean McPherson, with me this week. And while public works and infrastructure might not at first mention set the imagination alight, in our case here in South Africa, if Dean McPherson doesn't get his job right, then we all face a bleak future. We're all in big trouble. So welcome, Minister. And we're going to talk about a potential game changer in public works because you recently went to London with an investment proposal so audacious, to me at least, that I assumed you'd be laughed out of court, but you weren't. In fact, your audiences were fascinated. And your proposition was this, that you're going to take all of the land and the property owned by the state and bundle it into a new property company in which private investors can participate and invest, and which you reckon is worth about 155 billion rand. That's roughly £7 billion or $8 billion, and that's serious money. And I'm interested, Minister, in what's driven you to do this. It's not as if you don't already have enough on your plate.
Thanks, Peter. It's great to be with you again. I came to the conclusion that if we try and deal with our properties just as land and buildings, and don't actually see the real economic value that lies within them, we're going to continue to make the same mistakes, which misses the growth opportunity and investment opportunity that we have in them. Now, the interesting thing for me is that the state actually considered this matter in 1997. There's a government white paper that was approved. It was then affirmed by the cabinet in 1999, and nothing was ever done about it since then. And what the department did is it created a super branch called, what's notionally called the PMTE, which is the Property Management Trading Entity, but it does nothing of the sort. Effectively, what it does is it just manages these assets to the best of its ability, and doesn't really achieve anything. It's also a function of an economic question that I asked myself in the department, that if the maintenance backlog of these assets is 30 billion rand and climbing, and of course that sort of budget is not available to us, Treasury is not going to bail us out, we have to find a mechanism to do something about it, but also to protect the underlying value of those assets. So you know, if you wanted to put it on a graph, you have an inclining maintenance backlog and a declining property value. And those two are going to intersect at a point where if a decision wasn't made quickly, that the damage actually may become irreversible and government may have anything between a 30 and 50 billion rand hole on its balance sheet that it needs to fill due to these collapsing buildings around the country. So, you know, we asked ourselves, what do we do then? So I've had some discussions with many in the private sector and those in private equity. We also looked at other examples around the country, around the world at least, particularly Singapore, Malaysia, and the Middle East. And they all had one thing in common, if you have to look for a common thread, is that they used their government assets to build generational and national wealth, and that they monetized them. They retained the ownership of them. They got rid of that which they don't need, and they were then able to actually use those as anchors for sovereign wealth funds. And that's where we got to the point that we did. We've also done a lot of background work. And what we presented in London, as you said, Peter, was, in my view, a very well thought out and researched business case. It was very well received by, I think in the one room, someone said to me, we had $29 trillion worth of assets under management. So these are not people who don't know what they're talking about. And they said, these are the exact kind of investment opportunities that we're looking for in South Africa.
So you managed to get mention of the plan into President Cyril Ramaphosa's State of the Nation address in February. And I know nothing about government, but I do know that there's always a bit of a crush to get from various departments in government to get their plans into the State of the Nation address. And you were fortunate. You were one of those who got their plan mentioned. Some ministers didn't get their plans mentioned. And I just wanted to ask you, I mean, so having read a number of these State of the Nation addresses, where the president flags something as something that he wants to do, sometimes they just drift away and get, you know, they fall by the wayside, and you remember them again in 3 or 4 years' time, and it's all too late. Can you just tell us anything about your interaction with the president, if you've had one directly, about this property company that gives you the confidence that this might have legs?
Yes, it's a conversation that the president and I actually had on the 16th of August, 2024. The president is a investor in property, understands property, and so do I. And so I really tried to look at this through the lens of, you know, how do you monetize these assets while actually building long-term value? And that's the discussion that we had, is how do we separate the non-core assets from the core assets, and then how do we actually build structured value over time? And so he gave me a couple of ideas. I discussed some of my ideas, and it was really that engagement. It was a fairly lengthy engagement that then we started working out how we would put this together. Because what I wanted to be very clear of is that I didn't want the president to go to the State of the Nation and say, you know, I have this idea, and then, as you said, some of these things never come to fruition. That's just not how I operate. Is that I wanted something that I knew that he could say, that he could talk about, that he could sort of maybe just, you know, sort of dip his toe in the water, and that we would then expand on. And that's really the strategy that we've had, is that following on from that, I expanded on that in my reply to the State of the Nation. We then had a very clear a business case that was then ready to be advanced. And then, you know, that fitted in nicely with our visit to the JSE Macroeconomic Summit in London. And we are now at the point where we are finalizing the acquisition of a program director who will now actually take this forward for us. So very exciting, and we're making good good strides. But for us, Peter, you know, we have to show substantial progress. So we've put some big markers on the ground to say what things need to look like in 24 months' time, but at the same time, be able to actually get some of these projects moving at the same time.
Yeah. So I want to come to the projects themselves in a minute, but just once again, sort of in your mind, how will it work? I mean, you can't be expected to run a sort of sharp as a pin commercial proposition like this from inside a government department. So will the unit have its own, you know, fancy headquarters, you know, the kind of thing that a private investor might want to walk in and be impressed by? As you say, you're looking for a project director. Does this person then become the chief executive of the company? And lastly, two things. One, how much rope does she or he have? And i.e., how independent of government do you think, how much independence can you tolerate? And two, do you eventually list this property company on the JSE, or if not only the JSE, perhaps in London as well, where you say it was so well received?
So let me say that I'm absolutely dedicated and committed to ensuring that it has as much independence as is humanly possible. And I think that that is critically important, because if we want to take commercial and financial decisions, those need to be done on that basis and that basis alone. Of course, there is every incentive for government, in my view, to support that decision, because if you look at how the company and fund would be structured, is that it would derive a dividend or produce a dividend every year from return of investment. And so the more commercial decisions it takes and the better it does, the more dividend there is for government then to be able to support other social infrastructure projects that may not be commercially viable. I've also, in the talks that I've had with a couple of individuals, have also committed that they will have independence and that they will be able to take the decisions that are needed. I mean, of course, as the, you know, the executive authority of that, you know, I would want to be able to, give some direction and be able to give some guidance and also to be able to provide a buffer between them and government. So I think that that's incredibly important. But it's evidently clear that having an entity in the department has not worked, and that's what currently exists at the moment. And so we need to deal with it on that basis. The next point that I would make is around how the company is structured, is that you actually have the property development company, and then you have the property fund. And we separate those, Peter, for two reasons, because we understand that private equity and sovereign wealth funds cannot invest in project-specific projects. They can only invest in a fund that derives a dividend for them. So our view is that we would have varying types of funds, 7-year, 10-year funds that derive dividends, and then we would then be able to disperse them on that basis while using that fund to drive the actual development through PPPs on a project-by-project basis. The interesting point that we had, or the discussion that I had, particularly with the JSE when I was in London, is that they see immense value of being able to actually list some of these funds, as we've seen in places like Singapore. And we are going to be working with them on how to structure that. We're going to get the best of the best expertise on how to actually manage that and get those funds listed, of course, over time.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got four categories of investment in mind, and we'll just work from sort of big down to not so big. First of all, you mentioned sort of big office precincts to bring government services together in small and big towns. You, Worcester, Johannesburg is another one. There's a Tswane and other, and I noticed Ngamakwe, which I assume is the same dust blown, deeply rural Ngamakwe I grew up near in the old Transkei, but which is probably it serves a lot of people. So what these big developments, you're basically grouping government services, right? Be they, you know, the Home Affairs, social grants, what police sometimes. These are big projects.
Peter, one of the things that I don't understand, and is that is an obvious contradiction, is that the government is the largest landowner and owner of buildings, three times the size of Growth Point,
as an example, being a listed company
that generates profits and generates income, which we don't, is that we have all of these empty buildings and yet we continue to lease buildings from the private sector. That is that is actually damning, quite frankly. And so what we say is that we think that being the landlord and being the one that signs leases, that we're in a unique position to drive these government entities into specified precincts. So we actually guarantee the tenants and rental for those, which is an amazing proposition for developers to come and develop those government precincts to say, we'll put in the asset for no cost. We'll retain the ownership of it. We'll put it out to a 50-year or 99-year development lease. We'll guarantee you the clientele for this amount of square meters and this rate per square meter. And then what you want to do on top of that is up to you. And when we look at Tshwane, and the government precincts have been spoken about for a long time, there's cabinet decisions that departments must be in the capital, which makes sense. Just that project, phase one, is 30 billion rand, and we can save 400 million rand a year in 35 cancelled leases. So that makes sense to us. And while I appreciate that many, like Minister Schreiber, is, you know, driving home affairs at home, as he would call it, there will always be a need and a requirement for government departments to be located in buildings. And it's about how do you do that smartly and cleverly. You know, I was in Johannesburg last week, and we are building the first high-rise building in the city center for 20 years. And it's going to house the deeds office, where we will not have leases there, very expensive leases. And that is right next to the court where all of those transfers take place. The building is being outfitted so that it is able to digitize its records and so on. And that makes sense. So you actually take where the deeds office is, you locate it to another government service, you're able to drive inner city regeneration, you're able to, you know, bring lawyers and all of the other associated services that are around that closer. And I think that that's a smart strategy, just from being able to offer quicker government services, but also able to offer value for money to the taxpayer in how we spend their money on these services.
So a couple of things come to mind. First of all, you're talking about taking out of the property market a lot of rent in order to reallocate it to the properties that you and I are going to develop. Does that damage the property market in any way? In other words, are you taking, I don't know how much money you mentioned, was it 30 billion rand of rent being paid, which will no longer go to those property owners? What are they expected to, what will happen to those buildings?
Well, it's actually a, you know, it's actually 6 billion a year that we pay on leases. Okay. And let me say that there's two things that that are evident there. The first one is the analysis that we've done is that we probably pay between 17 and 34% over market value for some of these leases. So we're in leases that are very expensive and are clearly not value for money. It's also clear, Peter, that we're not going to cancel all of those leases all at once. It's a phased approach. And even if we were to save 50% on those lease costs, that's 3 billion rand a year into our own assets that actually accumulate value over time. So I think that that's important. I've had a very interesting discussion with a listed property company that have been an immense resource to us. And I said, if we get this right, what is your view? And they said, well, it would probably double their share price because it would take all of this undervalued, underdeveloped commercial space across the country and actually give it a value. And that's good for their property portfolio and anyone's property portfolio. So we actually see it differently. We think that we would actually add value to the property sector as opposed to undercut it.
And presumably, as the state would guarantee the rentals or payment of the rent for the buildings that are now fall under your plan, if the Department of Land Affairs or whatever it might be is now in building X, you would guarantee to an investor that that rent would be paid, right? Is that a gilt-edged promise? Is the state put its name and does the state put itself behind the rentals?
Well, obviously, when we create these public-private partnerships, let's say on a government precinct or on a specific building, we'd be obviously very clear about what our intentions are and what we expect. So if the building is 10,000 square meters, as an example of commercial space, government might say, well, you know, we need 5,000 for these two departments. And the balance of the 5,000 is for yourself. It would be this department and this would be the guaranteed rental per square meter that we'd be able to pay. The key thing is this, and I think that we mustn't get away from this. What we are saying is that we aren't A lot of people have said, well, why don't you just sell everything? I mean, that's an option. I think that if you had to put 155 billion rand into the property market, you'd probably collapse it, because you would just have this extreme oversupply. But what we are saying is that we will retain the ownership of key assets, and we would then put those in for effectively zero cost. So you're actually lowering the cost of these developments, as opposed to saying, well, we want 100 or 200 million rand for the asset, and it might never actually take off. I also want to make this point, Peter, because I think it's important. The state can't own everything and it can't sell everything. There's got to be a balance between, what can it actually monetize and what can it actually derive value from versus what it doesn't need. So how can we cut down on maintenance? How can we cut down on security costs, operational costs, rates and taxes, all that sort of thing? So we've identified around 1,600 properties already that we can dispose of. And we're pushing ahead with that. And we can generate some money at least then to also operationalize our project.
Probably also worth just saying for people who don't know South Africa that well, that is, there is a degree of corruption in the fact that government departments rent space in buildings other than the ones which they own. And these rents may be high. There was a famous story not that many years ago about the police moving into a new headquarters and signing a deal with somebody who was a friend of the chief of police. So these things would become impossible once you form this company, I presume.
Absolutely. It really astounds me as to some of the rental costs that we seek to pay. I instituted a new system when I was appointed minister that I can't sign leases, but I can provide concurrence for them. And I just asked a couple of simple questions: market analysis, comparative prices per square meter, and so on. And I'll never forget, I got a price per square meter for a commercial building in Polokwane. Now, I have nothing against Polokwane; it's a lovely place. But 150 rand a square meter for Polokwane is not realizable or justifiable. I mean, those are Sandton sort of prices. And it just goes to show that, that there's a lot of money to be made in this. In fact, we've taken severe action against officials in that space for cooking the books with landlords. And often, Peter, people would use those contracts, so they would sign a lease agreement with us without even owning the building. They would then go and get finance, use that as sort of a guaranteed income, and then buy the building after we had signed a lease with them. It was mad.
So let's just move on to the other kinds of investment. So the government precincts are in they're big, and they're going to be useful to the public and help contain costs in government. And then you have also a group, and mainly in the Western Cape, of small harbour developments in places like Hout Bay near Cape Town, Gansbaai near Hermanus, and other Western Cape, mainly Western Cape locations, some of which really look quite exciting. I think the development planned at Hout Bay is of the order of about 2 billion rand. What these look like real propositions. I know for a fact, because I live not very far from Gansbaai, that in anticipation of the harbour being expanded or modernized, property prices in Gansbaai have become absurd. And people are paying many millions of rands for very, very simple and basic, face brick houses. So it already is having an effect, and certainly in the Cape, in these locations, I get the investment proposition.
Lucky it's a little bit further down the road from yourself and Stanford, So hopefully you'll be spared that property inflation. But we are very excited about that prospect, Peter, because those harbours are owned fully by us, and they have the most immense potential. And they've just been left to rot. And actually, you know, when you stand on the quay of Hout Bay Harbour, and I said this to someone the other day when I was at the V&A, the added advantage that you will have at Hout Bay is that you will get the ocean and a mountain. When you're at the V&A, all you do is look at the ocean and you have to turn around to look at the mountain. So there is immense underlying value to these precincts. And I have no doubt that the investment opportunity for that is going to be immense. But I've also said this, Peter, that they cannot just become commercial entities on their own. We've got to protect and respect the fishing heritage that exists in those precincts. So fishing will be a very big part of it.
Yeah.
We've also said that all of those that have existing leases will be given first preference and have sort of a period that they are able to have a subsidized a rental. And that's the real power of being able to retain the ownership of those assets, is that you can determine what it is that you want to get out of it. So, of course, we want strong residential, we want strong commercial and retail there, but we also want to maintain fishing. We also want to maintain those sort of community operators that are there. And then we also want to be able to have inclusionary housing as well in some of those. And we've made that very clear. And how do we benefit the community of Hungburg, which is behind Hout Bay? Saldanha is also a very exciting prospect for us. And we have, you know, everyone is really knocking on our door on those projects because they are so exciting. There's a clear investment case for them. We've actually appointed a project managers already for the program. So we're making some very good progress on getting those project proposals ready for bids.
So that's the small harbors. Then there's another element. I'm not sure whether these break down into specific funds or how they eventually are to be made investable. But you're also are talking about large tracts of land, which are available to you, upon which you can build housing or estates. Talk to me a little bit about that. I know there are a couple of military airports in Cape Town, Youngsfield, I think, and there was one or two others. You can build a lot of houses on there. I mean, you're talking about, you know, quite a couple of hundred hectares. These are big properties.
You know, Peter, last Friday, I spoke at a conference, and I said that South Africa needs to make up its mind. It either wants to maintain these large open tracts of land that are subject to invasion, that are subject to, you know, dumping and all sorts of other things, and whether those be military bases that are not really used. And it strikes me as odd that the city of Cape Town has 5 military bases located in it. I think it must be one of the only cities in the world that has that. And I'm not aware of any national security threats towards Cape Town, at least, that requires that sort of land. Or we must, you know, sort of be happy with these informal settlements that we see along the N2 between the airport and the city center. And for my mind, I think that the case is clear that we can definitely use Wingsfield and Youngfield to be developed. And, you know, Rudy Dix from the PMO and the Presidency Office is very supportive of putting those two pieces of land into their new housing structure, where they basically guarantee a rental subsidy per house, which they will transfer to the private sector to develop on that basis. And, you know, if we can do that and we can create incredible mixed use areas for that land, again, you can have some retail, you can have some sort of middle income housing, low income housing, It absolutely makes sense. And why does it make sense? Because you have two massive pieces of uninterrupted land that we don't have to charge a cent for. So just there, you can lower the cost per unit just by putting those in. We're also doing a pilot. We're going to do a pilot project also with them in the city of Johannesburg. We're going to put one of our buildings into that mix for mixed-use housing developments. And that's about, using the state's assets for public good. And we think that that is incredibly important. And again, to the private sector, you're signaling to them, we're going to put in the asset. So we're going to do this deal with you. We're going to guarantee and underwrite 6,000 rand per month housing subsidy per unit. The rest is over to you. And we think that there's immense opportunity there.
So in places like Youngsfield and Wingfield, there's room there for thousands of houses, right? Or apartments or whatever one is going to build. I mean, this is a...
I stand to be corrected, but I recall a figure of between the two of them around 40,000 residential opportunities. And that's why we must make the choice. We're either going to have these barren pieces of land and continue with informal settlements, or we're going to do something about it. And I'm determined to do something about it.
Yeah. And then we come to the last, and this is, for me, the most partly amusing but also intriguing part of the proposition. It's what you call your operational portfolio. And from, as I understand, what the documentation you've already made public, it consists entirely of about 884 police stations. Everybody knows what a dreadful state most of our police stations have fallen into. But you seem to be suggesting that there may actually be an investment proposition. How would that work?
Absolutely. And you also forgot the union buildings and parliament as well, in there as well. Yeah. And what we're saying, Peter, is we're saying that, that again, the state pays to be in those buildings. So why not use that as a opportunity to say, to the private sector to maintain those buildings or develop new buildings that you have an underlying contribution to towards. We're also saying that there's opportunities for the company to cross subsidize some of those some of those redevelopments, some of that maintenance, particularly for the union buildings. It strikes me the union buildings is the most beautiful building in this country, and walking around it is just breathtaking, but the maintenance is not where it should be. So deriving that dividend and running that commercial entity is so important, so that you can use that and cross subsidize into those police stations, into the National Assembly, into the union buildings, so that they don't become the drain on the fiscus that they currently are.
And then so of all this project, and it's huge, and you're talking of timelines up to 10 years, and you're probably not going to be the Minister of Public Works for the next 10 years, much as you might be enjoying the job. What's going to be the most difficult, do you think? I mean, what do you anticipate will be the hardest nuts to crack?
I think that showing proof of concept, and that's why we, we're not pushing the boat on that. We're picking a couple of projects to show that it can work, and we said we're going to do two things at the same time. One, we're going to build the entity. And two, we're going to show that proof of concept. And so by the time we get to 1 or 2 years' time, those assets will then be able to transfer immediately into the entity. I think that being able to deal with skepticism is important. And granted that, South Africa doesn't have a great track record of doing things like this, so I appreciate that that's a tough nut to crack. Also being able to, guard the independence of the entity and the project director is really important to me. But I think that there's good examples where that has been done and how successful it is. Some people say, well, this is not a great idea. I said, well, also doing nothing is not a great idea. So, we have to do something, or else we're going to end up in a lot of trouble assume. And then I think thirdly, it is being able to show those results. So you know, 1, 2, and 3 actually are all intrinsically linked. And if you can do that in 12 to 24 more months' time, I think that we would have broken the back of that doubt.
Just talk to me briefly about the program director, not the program, sorry, it's a very South African word, about the project director. What are you looking for? Who are you going to get? I mean, without naming them, you know, what are we talking here? Very experienced person in property management or in property investment, what development?
You know, we're looking for someone who is just absolutely determined to do this. First of all, they've got to be 100% committed to the vision. Secondly, they've got to be a systems person. This actually is going to come down to systems. You know, I think often we make the mistake that, you know, that you have to be this or that, you know, to make it in a certain industry. For me, I actually believe, you know, in systems and being able to build that systems guarantees success. And I think that's thirdly someone that the public is going to look at and say, you know what, this, you know, this is a serious entity, and you know they wouldn't be putting their name behind this if they didn't believe in it. And I think that also deals with the doubts.
Right. Okay, and this person presumably would be a South African.
Yes. I would prefer them to be a South African, to understand how government works, to understand how the private sector works.
Yeah.
Is going to be preferable.
Right. And so as you come to the point where you're now saying to various departments, okay, you've got to move, we want you to move from where you are now and move into this new precinct that we start planning, all of that, you will come across some resistance. And I just wonder, you know, you are going to need the very strong political support of the president. And this is all going to be happening, will be quite intense by the time the 2029 national elections come around. You don't have much choice, I know this, but you know, how confident are you that you're going to get the support you need?
I am under no illusion that things in government change. I've been around for nearly 2 years and I've seen that myself. So, yeah. But I am confident that I do have the support of those that I need the support of, and there are multiple people. You know, also the other thing, Peter, is that we mustn't underestimate that, you know, that investors want this, you know, so you've got a push pull, both within government and both within the private sector, as well. And that's why I'm being blunt around what are the risks, but what are the choices of not doing anything? And I make the point around military bases that we don't use or informal sectors. I mean, it's very easy. So it's not going to be easy. Nothing in government is easy. And if it was easy, it probably would have been set up in 1999 when it was first discussed. But I do think that the landscape is different then. I think that the market is different today. And I think with enough pushing, we can get across the line.
So just so that I perfectly understand this, you are talking about property and land owned by the national government, not by municipalities or provinces. Is that right?
That's correct. It's only that which falls under the Department of Public Works and Infrastructure. But there is opportunities, I think, in time to come, that we can when we are putting structured deals together, there's no reason why Transnet can't put an asset into that, and we can create a joint venture anything. So I think that the possibilities are open as we go along.
And so the other, you know, the larger government holding in land, which I think is it 5 million hectares? It's a massive amount of. That's not part of this project, right? I mean, that's going, you know, we should be starting getting people to farm that land or whatever it might be, but you're not putting that into this investment proposition.
I think what we've said, to be very clear, is we want to take those assets that we know we can generate investment on.
Okay.
Now, it may be so that there is a piece of land next door to you that is owned by us, and it might be worth a million rand or so, but
Yeah.
that's not going to be commercially viable
Yeah.
for an investment case. So on that basis, we would dispose it, or we would send it to another department. Maybe your local municipality may want to use it. So it's really based on how we can attract and drive investment,
Okay.
and it's on a case by case basis. It's not on
Great.
a it's but just those projects that you've seen in the business case, I mean, that's 155 billion rand just on that score. That's not even including the vast tracts of land as well.
Mister, you were very quick out of the starting blocks in your new job, 2024, declaring that you wanted to turn South Africa into a construction site. And there were many meetings and I'm sure conferences and plans made. But I just wonder, just generally, as we come to the end of our conversation, how that's all going. And I live far away from big construction projects you were talking about, so I don't see all the activity. But I remember that Infrastructure South Africa, which falls under your ministry, had a build book worth hundreds of billions of rands, and I think you said told me at the time that quite a few of them were fully funded. And I remember you saying that fully funded didn't mean all the money was there, but that the Treasury had budgeted for the spend. How's that all going? I mean, are you on track with all of those plans? Have some fallen behind, fallen off, some moving ahead? Because you were in water, in rail, in roads, there was and electricity, there was a lot going on.
Yes, Peter. I mean, let me say this, that I think that over the last 18 months, we've fundamentally got onto a trajectory which is now irreversible. And if you look in the last 12 months, we have doubled that construction book from 125 billion to 250 billion. We have seen construction contributing in the third quarter nearly half of all new jobs. And we saw construction turn positive for the last two quarters of last year. Quarter three was 0.1%. Quarter four was 2.5%. The FNB construction index has turned positive for the first time in 11 years. So I think that the confidence that we are able to do what we need to do is there. We also launched the Construction Action Plan, which actually brings synergy to all of the provinces and nationally to deal with matters like ensuring that tenders are awarded on time, that they aren't cancelled, so on. We've also been blacklisting companies that don't work. So, I mean, if you go and look at Infrastructure SA's, social media, you see that nearly on a weekly basis, we are now taking out to market projects that are ready for bids. And that just shows me that we are on the right track. Is there more that we could do? Absolutely. I mean, I think that we come off of a low base, but there's no doubt in my mind that that direction is positive. We're headed in the right direction. I now have a permanent head of infrastructure, which they haven't had since Nkosi Nzo Ramakgopa left. Mametse Masemola, you should interview her one day. A very smart
I'd
woman.
love
Uh,
to,
we have we now have a agreement for the Minister of Finance that ISA will be a schedule entity now, so they will have more ability to actually get things done. Just yesterday, I got an email from a energy project in the Eastern Cape saying, we need some help from you guys. We hit some bottlenecks. Can you do so? I said, absolutely. We're converting an urgent meeting to do so. So we're headed in the right direction. We'd love to do more. But I think that construction site is definitely unfolding. There's not cranes everywhere, but I can tell you there's a lot more cranes today than there was 2 years ago.
I watch the annual results reporting of some of the construction materials groups like PPC, the cement company. In their most recent report, they were saying, well, look, there was a lot of activity around South Africa, but not in South Africa. They still are saying that they wish South Africa would, the market would pick up so they can sell more cement. And obviously, you know, cement is one of those lovely products because it's very local. It's not something you can really import, not if you, unless you're crazy. But PPC is not feeling it yet. And that must be a worry.
Yeah, I mean, of course. And, you know, I've also had this discussion to say, you know, the cost of these materials is important. Yeah. Can we afford to have rising steel prices? Can we afford to have, you know, cement that's being dumped in South Africa? And, you know, I know you've written extensively about that issue as well. And so it's complex, and it's complex to manage that pipeline and to ensure that what the state is building, you know, that we are driving demand as well, but that we're also able to get it the best price possible. And I think that might probably be a discussion for another day, because I have quite a lot of views on it. I know you do too. But of course, we want to, you know, a measure of success, and I've said this, is I want to see share prices of construction companies and material companies going up. I think that would be a good performance indicator for us as well.
Yeah. So in all of this, Minister, you and Cyril Ramaphosa, the president, come from different political parties, but it's hard to imagine what is happening now and your enthusiasm and your positive view on the future. It's hard to imagine that would have happened without someone like him, if not him exactly, in the job. I mean, he really has, in the best way that he is able to, been able to push this kind of revival, perhaps, in our economy, and a bit of ambition into government. Or have I got that wrong?
You know, I think this president speaks often to us about having a higher ambition and having a not settling for average. You know, I think leading a coalition government is incredibly difficult. And I've certainly appreciated his support that he's given me. I've also, you know, appreciated the support of my colleagues around me. And where we don't see eye to eye, we are able to, you know, maybe sit down behind the quiet of the door that not many people see and try and have these things out. And, you know, maybe we in South Africa, we love a bit of, theater and argy-bargy, but, you know, sometimes that's not necessary to get things done. And maybe people miss that point of what goes on in this government. But that's not to say that it's all sort of roses and milk tart. It can be difficult, and there are times that we disagree. But I think being able to do so collegially is important. You know, yesterday I was at the golf at Steyn City.
I saw you,
and it was phenomenal. You know, we must never underestimate how many people want this country to work, how patriotic people are to make this country work. Yeah. And I think that sometimes political parties might miss that on both sides of the aisle, and that they miss that patriotism and that deep love that people have for this country to make it work.
Yeah. Have you been surprised, though, about how slow it all can be and how complex? You know, how do you deal with that? I always remember as a boy, in my real early years, 1965, still at school, as a boy living in Umtata, and my father, who was a building contractor there, speaking very excitedly about a dam that was going to be built on the Mzimfulu River.
I know what you're going to, you're going to pick that up.
And would hopefully bring some small businesses. Well, anyway, that same dam is still on your to-do list today.
The president keeps talking about it. He says, I've been in office for like 10 years and we're still talking about the Umzimvubu dam. You know, there's a great thing that I've come up with in government. It's called hurry up and wait.
Yeah.
And it is frustrating. And I really think that, you know, government does no favors by the amount of time that it takes to get anything done. And I've also come to the conclusion that there's a lot of people invested in something not happening. as well. So there's a lot of people who delay, frustrate processes, and that's also equally unacceptable. And I do think that while we talk about a Marshall Plan for the economy, I think we need a Marshall Plan for process to speed up processes and just to cut through things. But I also understand that there's no real incentive to do so, because every decision you take is challenged nonstop. And so sometimes people say, you know what, it's easier in my life not to make a decision, because then I don't have to fill in 100 forms. I don't have to have the public protector breathing down my neck. I don't have to appear before a court. And that is perverse, actually. So we've got to try and find a middle ground that we can protect process. We can, you know, ensure that we do things correctly, but that we're able to get it done a hell of a lot more quickly than we do at the moment.
Well, I mean, you know, you've only got to look at a couple of episodes of that old, famous old British TV program, Yes Minister, to realize, no matter how amusing it was, to realize what role a highly professional public service or civil service can play. Even if, whether it's to block you or to make your way forward easier, they sort that out in their own club. And at least if you're the minister, you come up against something you can't move, you try something different. You take their advice, but we are not quite there yet. And it must be exhausting. So we thank you for your service, Minister Dean McPherson. We'll have to end it there. And thank you for generously giving me some of your time, and good luck with the property project. Thank you all for listening. I'll be back soon with another edition of Podcasts from the Edge. Until then, take care and be safe. Bye-bye.